With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the Westlands Water District surpasses its groundwater recharge goal, and the Ag Labor Working Group is making official policy recommendations. We'll have more on both those stories. But our top story today, the Risk Management Agency knows that finding the right risk management tools for specialty crops and for smaller scale farmers can be overwhelming. That's why the RMA created a new searchable directory of crop insurance agents who have experience selling whole farm revenue protection and micro farm policies. I talked with RMA Administrator Marcia Bunger to get all the details.
Definitely. So we've always had the functionality for people searching for a crop insurance agent to go to our agent locator page on our RMA website, but we have updated that and we're still transitioning to a format that is probably better searchable. But this is the interim type of look, is that we've asked crop insurance agents across the country to self-identify if they are experts in selling whole farm revenue. And by providing us that, we've now created a new searchable directory on our page when you go to locate an agent. And so we're hoping that will give producers that maybe weren't always in the traditional lane of crop insurance, but yet, you know, they're very interested in having a policy that will cover their specialty crop farms, their vegetable farms, maybe, you know, urban ag types of operations. And so that, you know, that is where we're at right now. And so the new directory, I believe, has like over 1,100 crop insurance agents listed. And so when we look at that coverage, it is across all 50 states. I think, though, it's important to note that there are some states where the agent doesn't physically live in that state, because you are able to be licensed in more than one state. So you might have an agent that is in the neighboring state that would be the closest to a producer. But again, just because they don't live in your state doesn't mean they can't sell or write whole farm for you.
Right. So, and as you pointed out, these are some tools that maybe people who haven't necessarily used them before or haven't necessarily been involved in these products before. Our audience is largely specialty crop growers. And so how will this benefit them, and what should they really be aware of at this time?
Okay, so once they locate an agent, or even if they want to explore the options available to them prior to getting a hold of an agent, we do write a number of specialty crops as standalone policies. You know, I don't want to misspeak, but like olives. So we have olive policies, but in many instances, we don't have policies for every last single type of crop that might be being grown out there. So that is why RMA developed the whole farm revenue protection policy concept. And we've had that around for a number of years, but about 2 years ago, we did some tweaking and changing. Because of feedback, because it is somewhat paperwork burdensome, we've tried to reduce the paperwork for that whole farm revenue policy. We've also doubled the maximum insurable revenue. Today, it is at $17 million, because a lot of these specialty crops are high-dollar crops. You know, I think of grapes as an example. But so we've doubled the insurable revenue. And then along with those changes to that whole farm revenue policy, we came up with, I call it the baby sister to WFRP, and that's called microfarm. And that is for small operations, and basically removing a lot of the red tape for that policy. After a year of piloting that, we had a lot of feedback that said, you know, actually, the revenue limit is too low, even for small operations. So we tripled the eligible or the insurable revenue for that microfarm policy. And so it's now at $350,000. So it captures a lot of, I think, your small operations, your urban ag operations, where they are marketing either to co-ops, through co-ops, or they're also having a roadside stand and selling their vegetables.
We'll continue the conversation with RMA Administrator Marcia Bunger later in the show. This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, this time of year, the prices we pay for eggs at the grocery store are as changeable as the weather. Gary Crawford has more.
We're on an Easter egg hunt. We've got our baskets ready.
Ah, but these days, most kids are hunting those plastic eggs, not the real ones. But one expert does say demand for eggs still goes up at this time of year because many people are doing a lot more cooking and baking. And, of course,
it is kind of hard to bake with plastic eggs.
That sounds like the voice of experience there. That laugh comes from USDA economist Shale Shagum. He says those real eggs will likely cost us more than they did a year ago. USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service has done a nationwide scan of hundreds and hundreds of published ads for eggs, and the results...
A dozen white grade A eggs are averaging about $2.92 a dozen, compared to about $2.28 a dozen a year ago.
One reason, avian influenza or bird flu,
which has hit the egg-laying flock pretty hard.
At last count, the flock was about 1% smaller than a year ago, so egg supplies are down, demand is up, and that is sending prices up, even at the wholesale level where supermarkets are trying to compete with each other for the limited supply of eggs out there.
You know, retailers will often, to bring people to the stores, will offer specials. And, you know, depending on when they bought those eggs, in the short term, they may be willing to, you know, sell them for less at retail than they were buying them at wholesale. Again, part of the issue, if you're especially around the holiday season, is you want to make sure you have, and you've already put the ads in place and made the decision that these are the items you're going to be specialing. You want to make sure you have that supply. Nobody wants to go to the store to do their shopping, and even if they're given a rain check, you know, they want to have the item available. So to some extent, the store is going to pay what it has to pay to secure the supplies that they need.
So that they can use bargain prices for eggs to draw us customers in to buy other items for those springtime holiday meals. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
At the Ag and Food Policy Summit hosted by AgriPulse at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on Monday, a panel of experts discussed the keys to rebuilding export markets and overseas demand for U.S. agricultural goods. Dan Hallstrom, president and CEO of the U.S. Meat Export Federation, said that higher shipping rates and logistical challenges around the world, like shipping uncertainty in the Red Sea due to pirate activity, are concerning for all industries, not just agriculture.
These sorts, they seem one-off, but they're really not. Those of us in international world, we know that these vessels don't just go to the Red Sea, they're going around the world. So what you're doing is you're adding more cost, more time, more inputs, higher across the board. So the more these conflicts happen or continue to happen, the higher the cost of logistics and freight will be.
Cam Quarles, CEO of the National Potato Council, said the international issues are tremendously complicated.
No single individual, no single entity is going to solve these. We have to have good coordination amongst all of the various agencies, all of the great people in the Foreign Service working in posts around the world. You've got to have strong collaboration with all of our industry folks and our technical partners to get these things right. Sometimes it literally takes decades. We've seen that. But it's ultimately worth it when you can move the needle in that significant way.
Hallstrom said the U.S. Meat Export Federation is extremely optimistic going forward for export markets and overseas demand.
I have always looked at it this way, that the more success we have, the more issues that come up. So all the more reason that we have to be aligned as industries. I'm not just talking beef and pork, I'm talking agriculture. Agriculture is the backbone of the American economy. And I think with the folks in this room, on this panel, with FAS, USTR, USDA, we're well equipped to handle the challenge.
According to the USDA, the value of U.S. agricultural exports, not adjusting for inflation, peaked in fiscal year 2022 before declining in 2023. Total exports were valued at $178.7 billion in 2023, which is a $17 billion decrease from 2022. That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's Livestock News, the Dairy Sheep Association of North America's Genetic Evaluation Program is being held on March 27th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern Time. The Genetic Evaluation Program helps North American sheep milk producers use their used milk production records to make more informed decisions in their breeding stock programs through the use of genetic analysis performed in Quebec. In this webinar, GEP Coordinator Matt Gelblax and GEP user Kristen Waddell, both full-time sheep dairy producers in the United States, will be joined by Emily St. Pierre of Genovis in Quebec to introduce the program, review what is required of producers to participate, explain estimated breeding values and how dairy sheep producers can use them, and explain how the flock production of any dairy sheep producer can improve with the use of EBVs. Find more information on this webinar at dsana.org. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The prune breeding program at UC Davis has a new cultivar available for growers. Program manager Sarah Castro said the new prune variety YOLO Gold is so far getting a positive response from industry members.
Technically, the patent name is UCG2S8, but the trademark name is UC YOLO Gold. This is a really unique item that we have internally in the program loved since 2009. We have, you know, many great prune growers who are at the whim of their processors in regards to what prunes they can grow and process. So the industry is still testing to see how accepted YOLO Gold might be. Right now, the processors have been very cooperative in testing and looking into this. But as many prune growers know, we need a lot of fruit to run through our machines to determine whether or not a fruit would be successful in the industry.
The business advisory provider Pinion has introduced Pinion Global Network, a collaboration of food and agricultural advisory firms worldwide. The network's aim is to empower farmers and agribusinesses internationally by sharing local and country-level insights. Its initial members include Pinion in the U.S., Pinion Advisory in Australia, and ACS 360 in South Africa. The strategic collaboration seeks to bring together thought leadership, growth, and resources from three nations. Founded in 2020, Pinion Advisory is focused on sustainability for ag operations, financially, socially, and environmentally. South Africa member ACS 360 serves a diverse clientele across industries such as agriculture, agro-processing, logistics, and automotive industries. The network plans to expand into Canada, the European Union, and South America. The Bipartisan Agricultural Labor Working Group has issued its final report aiming to tackle workforce issues in the agriculture sector, particularly addressing flaws in the H-2A visa program. Of the 21 policy recommendations covered in the report, 15 received unanimous support by the members. The establishment of a single portal for filing H-2A applications, streamlined recruiting processes, and expediting the review of delayed worker applications were among the recommendations highlighted in the report, which reflects input from farmers, ranchers, workers, and producers nationwide. Other recommendations include wage reform, granting year-round industries access to the H-2A program, and codifying special procedures currently in regulation. The final report serves as a roadmap for legislative solutions aiming to protect workers, ensure fair working conditions, and improve overall efficiency in the ag labor sector. Westlands Water District has surpassed its goal for groundwater recharge ahead of schedule. The district has successfully recharged 380,000 acre-feet of surface water into its aquifers since March of last year, surpassing its target of 275,000 acre-feet by the end of the water year. The achievement highlights the commitment and efficiency of district farmers who participated in groundwater recharge programs and incentives. These efforts included implementing various recharge projects such as basins, wells, and flood-managed aquifer recharge. With 527 approved groundwater projects, the district maximized its allocated water supply and utilized additional surface water from the Central Valley Project. Looking ahead, Westlands plans to continue prioritizing groundwater recharge initiatives in the next water year to enhance water supply stability and prepare for future needs. The 96th Annual State FFA Leadership Conference is set to begin tomorrow in Sacramento. Nearly 7,500 future Farmers of America members and supporters from across the state will celebrate agricultural education and the ag industry at the conference, taking place March 21st through the 24th at the Golden One Center in Sacramento. The conference is an opportunity for students to be exposed to a broad range of agricultural science, business, and technology career pathways while celebrating the accomplishments these leaders have achieved over the past school year. The conference also includes an expo to be held at the Safe Credit Union Convention Center, where members will have an opportunity to explore various post-secondary career and college opportunities. Over the course of 4 days, when students are not attending inspirational sessions, they can participate in various agricultural tours near Sacramento or engage in leadership workshops. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
The direct-to-consumer food market is becoming more popular. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The global direct-to-consumer food market is growing fast, according to a new report from Research and Markets. The growth of the DTC food market is driven by the rising adoption of convenience foods, growing online purchases of food products, and the increasing number of DTC food brands. The growing demand for premium and personalized food products is expected to generate market growth opportunities for stakeholders operating in this market. High competition from other distribution channels is a prominent challenge for those in the direct-to-consumer industry. Consumers' increasing focus on health and wellness is a major trend in the food market. North America is seeing the highest growth rate as more of us are having groceries delivered. The report says growth could be even more significant, but product quality concerns and delivery delays are some of the factors limiting growth of this market to some extent. This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Long before there was a U.S. Forest Service, women played an integral part in the preservation and conservation of our nation's forests. That, in turn, also grew opportunities for women in development and, eventually, leadership roles regarding forest stewardship. Rod Bain talks with a U.S. Forest Service historian about the role of women in developing U.S. forests and the U.S. Forest Service in this edition of Agriculture USA.
The contributions of women to the U.S. Forest Service and overall health, conservation, and enjoyment of our nation's forest. It is a storied, if not well-known, past, building up to the present of the agency and U.S. forest lands.
Being those lookouts into larger roles of fire management, aviation, hotshot crews, actual firefighting, making decisions on the ground.
I'm Rod Bain. Forest Service historian Rachel Klein joins us as we look at the legacy of women regarding our nation's forest in this edition of Agriculture USA. If one looks at the U.S. Forest Service and women's contributions to the agency and our nation's forest, a historical starting point for them may be dates of leadership.
Wendy Milner Harrett in 1979. She was hired as the first female district ranger on the Blanco Ranger District on the White River National Forest. We have Jerry Larson, who became the agency's first female forest supervisor on the Tahoe National Forest in California in 1985. All the way up to chief, with our first female chief of the Forest Service, Gail Kimball, in 2007. And most recently, our second female chief, Vicki Christensen, in 2018.
Yet Forest Service historian Rachel Klein notes, there have been significant contributions by women that go even beyond the formation of the agency in 1905, going as far back as when the Forest Service's predecessor, the Bureau of Forestry, was under Interior Department oversight in the 19th century.
Even prior to that, we have a lot of women who are engaging in environmental advocacy as early as 1850, at least in print.
The daughter of author James Fenimore Cooper wrote the journal-style book Rural Hours, discussing environmental conservation around that time.
She predates notable work like those of Henry Thoreau or George Perkins Marsh, and especially Aldo Leopold being a century prior.
The century also features the Forest Reserve Act in 1891, leading to creation of such reserves in public domain, due in part by advocacy from women's groups.
I see a lot of women advocating for the creation of forest reserves, for the creation of legislation that protects birds in particular.
Klein also points to significant contributions by women long before their establishment in official leadership roles.
What women did was they sought careers in forestry and conservation from different angles, if you will.
She elaborates.
A lot of women served in the Forest Service as advocates, as foresters, as rangers' wives, as clerks, information and education specialists, scientific researchers, and lookouts.
Several women in the first half of Forest Service history also studied ecological and environmental sciences like botany.
What they're doing in these different roles is really pioneering and supporting the development of the agency's forest management infrastructure.
Among examples of such efforts, Julia Shin, a paid clerk in the Sierra Nevada National Forest.
She was so well respected for her administrative skills that rangers and supervisors throughout the region would often look to her for advice.
Forest Service librarian Helen Stockbridge grew a resource library over three decades of service.
And she created numerous bibliographies for district rangers to draw from. She's showing how women are creating the information database for the agency to draw from.
Women were also involved in education and public outreach aspects of the U.S. Forest Service during the early years.
The creation of conservation education, that was established by women, particularly Edith Mosier. She illustrated numerous textbooks and USDA booklets that were forestry lessons for school children, but she also really instilled within these pages a conservation ethic, getting children to care about conservation and why they should care about the forest. Margaret March Mount, who served as the director of women's forestry in the 1940s, she was advocating for fire prevention long before Smokey ever did. She was fondly known as the ambassador of trees, who inspired children and women to plant millions of trees, and those forests can still be seen across the country today.
One more example of transformation of women's roles in the U.S. Forest Service over the decades.
We have Helen Dow, who was one of the first female forest lookouts in the Forest Service starting in 1919. And as fixed-point fire detection changed over the century, jobs like Helen's of being a lookout transformed into fire detection in different ways, particularly through aviation. So women literally moved from being that lookout atop of a mountain into flying that helicopter.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This year's farm income may end up being higher than the current projections. Gary Crawford has more.
USDA's first forecast for farm income this year was issued back in early February, and it projects about a 24% decline in net cash farm income this year. However,
I still believe that we will see a better income than what is projected.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack told a Monday session of AgriPulse's Food Policy Summit.
Oftentimes, that first projection is oftentimes quite pessimistic. And I'm hopeful that we'll see an uptick in income over the course of the year.
Vilsack said even if that does not happen, farmers are in better shape to handle a cut in income because of
3 years of historic growth in farm income, which has created strong liquidity in farm country, both in the ability to both meet short-term and long-term responsibilities and financial requirements.
So most analysts don't expect a surge of bankruptcies or foreclosures. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. Today I'm talking with USDA Risk Management Agency Administrator Marcia Bunger about a new searchable directory of crop insurance agents who have experience selling whole farm revenue protection and microfarm policies.
I think that that's so important to include those producers, and perhaps it's because I'm from California, I grew up growing to these roadside stands. And they've had for so long, they weren't able to protect all of their crops and their products the same way that other, producers in other parts of the nation were. So to get them included now, that probably has taken quite a bit of work on your part and for your department, hasn't it?
It definitely has, because there is so little data available for pricing and for yields that it has taken us some time to get to a point where we can offer this kind of product, but yet also abide by statute where it has to be actuarially sound. And so sometimes, you know, we hear from customers that, you know, gee, there isn't a product, or there isn't a policy for my specialty crop. So then now we are able to turn and say, well, have you considered whole farm or micro farm? And in most instances, no, they haven't, you know. So then that then ties in with, well, how do I get this policy? Well, you know, you need to find an agent near you. And we have available on our website now that agent locator piece that are selling these two types of policies and that have had probably a good amount of experience, training, and knowledge so that they can do a good job selling and servicing those policies.
So what's the best way for one of our listeners to find this online or to get more information?
You know, a couple different ways. They can go to the website, and that's found at www.rma.usda.gov, and go to the top of the homepage, and I think it's one of these the buttons, agent locator, and then you just access it that way, and it'll give you the option to search by zip code, address, city, state, and then you can see the list there. I think another source is that your neighbor who is in the same kind of operation, or maybe if you also are a member of a specialty crop organization representing, you know, your industry, to reach out to them. I mean, I would do it a couple different ways before landing on a particular agent, just to get some feedback. Because usually if there's somebody that has an agent in your immediate area, that's the best place to start. And the other thing that I think I would also add, and I haven't really talked about this much, but it's kind of like when you go to the doctor and he gives you an opinion, a second opinion, a third opinion, is sometimes needed. And I think that too is also something that everyone should consider. So just because you find an agent the first time, you know, sit down and talk with them. That doesn't mean you have to buy, but get a sense if you have a good feel for that probably long-term relationship. And if you don't, then maybe move on to the next and experience different agents and how they interact with you, what they probably have for experience. You're going to get a good sense of that. So some additional advice would be to shop around.
Yeah, that actually is something that we haven't mentioned a whole lot before, but it's probably always good advice is, yeah, shop around, make sure that it's a relationship that's going to work. Because like you said, a lot of the times these are long-term relationships.
Right. Yeah. Treat it like you're looking for car insurance. You're going to, while the price is the same, I think too, the agent, you know, should be consistent. Each agent you reach out to, it should also illustrate to you if the quotes are the same, because they should be the same. You know, if you give them the same information, what comes back to you is it should be the same quote. Mm-hmm. That's the constant. But again, you know, do you have a good sense? Am I going to get some good service? You know, how available are they when I have questions, especially for people that have never had crop insurance before? I mean, you're going to have a lot of questions in the first couple of years.
Thank you again to RMA Administrator Marcia Bunger. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. USDA's forecast for cotton this marketing year reflects year-over-year rises in several categories within the domestic production estimates and balance sheet. Rod Bain reports.
More cotton planted and harvested this season, and higher prices expected per USDA's cotton forecast for the 2024-25 marketing year. As USDA economist Stephen McDonald noted at this year's USDA Ag Outlook Forum,
USDA forecasting a 7.5% increase in planted area. Prices are significantly better than a year ago, and they've come up nicely.
With the season-ending average price forecasted up almost 4 cents year over year to reach 80 cents per pound this season. The expected increase in planted cotton area should translate to both more harvested acres and greater production.
We've got a 30-something percent increase in harvested area with five-year average yields regionally. We got a nice bump in our production, up almost 30%.
McDonald adds that also expected up year-over-year on the domestic cotton balance sheet.
Lower beginning stocks, but we get our supplies up nicely, and a nice increase in our ending stocks at a 23% stocks to use. I mean, we're still just in the what I would consider the realm of stocks to use, where it's not really anything to worry about.
Including exports, which should be at their highest totals in 3 years.
We can't very well export cotton we don't have. So since we have it, that's one reason why we'll be able to export it. But then again, we can't export it if no one will buy it. We have world import demand rising with world consumption rising. So some of those importing countries that haven't been so great this year will go up. China's imports will go down, but 10 million bales is not bad. Some of the increase in imports we see this year is going into bonded warehouses, and it'll come out next year. It'll enter spinning. They won't be buying as much, but they'll actually be consuming at least as much imported cotton.
In terms of what world cotton production for 2024-25 might look like, McDonald says the forecast points to a 3% increase from the previous year.
The U.S. is suddenly accounting for almost all the increase in world cotton. We are expecting a recovery due to normal yields in Turkey and also Greece. And then in Brazil, areas going up. We're expecting yet another record crop. And we have some small decreases elsewhere, lower area in China and India, average yields in Pakistan, and continued depletion of the reservoirs with normal weather in Australia.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
U.S. wheat continues to struggle in global markets. Exports are down to levels not seen in half a century. Here's Gary Crawford.
When it comes to the export situation for U.S. wheat,
we're struggling with very sluggish export demand.
USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski says sales have been slow for months, and we've seen some recent cancellations of purchases by China. And so
pulled our U.S. export forecast down by 15 million bushels. So now it's at 710 million bushels. That just reflects a sluggish pace of exports for hard red winter, which we reduced 5 million bushels, and an even more sluggish pace for soft red winter wheat, which we reduced 10 million bushels.
So add it all up and you get
the lowest U.S. export volumes since the early 1970s.
Wow, Mark says this season there are some unexpectedly large additions to world wheat supplies coming out of the Black Sea region. And so in this month's round of USDA forecasts,
we raised exports by Ukraine by 1 million tons this month. So now they're up to 16 million tons. And that's important to know because there's a war going on over there. And despite the war, and despite the lack of the Black Sea Grain Initiative, Ukraine is still able to export a lot of wheat. They've been pretty successful at shipping those exports out, and that increases, supplies to the global market and potentially weighs on global prices.
But it's not just Ukraine.
Also, we're seeing huge exports out of Russia, and we also raised the production forecast for Russia's crop. Still, I mean, relatively tight ending stocks globally, lowest since 2015-16. But that hasn't seemed to do much to support prices for wheat.
No, and in fact, Mark Chekanowski's Outlook Board has just lowered once again its season average wheat price forecast by another 5 cents, down to $7.15 a bushel. That would be almost 20% below last year's average all wheat price. Nonetheless, analysts say U.S. wheat still not price competitive on world markets compared to wheat from competing countries. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Provisions in a key piece of legislation called the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act are set to expire in 2025. Chad Smith has more on how the expiration would hurt farmers and ranchers.
The Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is a comprehensive tax cut package enacted in 2017. Dustin Shearer, Director of Government Affairs for the American Farm Bureau, says it's important legislation for farmers and ranchers.
It lowered taxes for most individuals as well as most businesses of every size and type, including farms and ranches. The legislation is important for farmers and ranchers because 98% of their operations are organized as pastures, and there were specific provisions included in the bill that benefit pasture businesses, including the broader brackets and lower rates, the enhanced estate tax exemption, and the 199A qualified business income deduction that drives more rate parity between the top rates that small businesses pay and the 21% corporate rate.
A new Economic Research Service report shows that if the provisions expire, tax bills will increase for farmers and ranchers.
If nothing is done to extend them beyond 2025, farmers will face well over a $9 billion tax increase in 2026 between increased income tax liability and the increased estate tax liability. According to that report, the expiration of 199A alone would see certain farms' tax liability increase by up to 20%.
Shearer says knowledge about your own personal tax liabilities is key when advocating for reauthorization of these provisions.
Arm yourself with information. Do some research or talk to your CPA to understand how these various provisions of the tax code are benefiting your operation and how your operation is utilizing the savings from the provisions enacted by the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And once you do that, talk to your elected officials, tell them your personal story, and tell them what the consequences would be if these options went away. Educating elected officials with personal stories is the best advocacy there is.
Chad Smith, Washington.
That's today's Top Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.